Hello and welcome to the latest episode of our Executive Career Chat series, where we interview leaders from different sectors and find out what makes a truly effective leader in today's business landscape. This is a landscape where the role of the business leader has probably been forced to evolve on many levels at a rate never seen before. And this is a great opportunity for successful leaders to share their experiences with the wider business community. My name's Dan Saunders. I'm an associate partner in the finance practice at Page Executive. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Irfan Mohammed. Irfan is a regional finance director for Chromalloy, responsible for a large finance function across multiple sites and territories within the EMEA region. Chromalloy is a US-owned global manufacturing group serving the aviation, energy and military sectors, turning over $1 billion and employing 4,500 people. Irfan's also held FD positions for high-profile international organisations in the aerospace, consumer goods, and automotive industries. Irfan, thanks very much for joining me today.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for having me on the series.
So, I think the best place to kick off would be if you could tell us a bit more about the trajectory of your career so far, and perhaps share with us a few career highlights.
Sure. So, I've been in finance for over 27 years, and having started in finance after finishing university in 1994, or as my kids like to call it, the end of the last century. After joining BAE Systems, I soon joined British Airways as a finance analyst and was promoted to financial planning manager whilst at British Airways and qualified as a senior accountant. I then soon moved to Jaguar Land Rover back in the Midlands, who at the time were owned by Ford Motor Company. And after doing a couple of finance manager roles there, I moved overseas with Ford Motor Company in 2005, initially to South Africa, and then to Thailand, where I held a couple of regional roles based in Bangkok. My first finance director role was actually in Indonesia, where I worked for a tannery business. And then soon after that, I joined a US aerospace business in the Philippines as their finance director and helped establish a greenfield site and grew that business over 4 years. I came back to the UK in 2016, actually, and joined an automotive supplier where I worked a turnaround business, turning the loss-making business into a profit over 2 years. And we grew that business by over 120% top line over 4 years. As you said, I'm now working as the regional finance director for Chromalloy, covering the UK, Europe, Middle East and Asia. I guess a highlight for me really were the opportunity of working and living overseas and getting to know people and cultures in countries like South Africa and Asia, which has enriched my experience and also given my wife and kids a much broader outlook and appreciation of opportunities outside of the UK.
Irfan, talk to me a bit about some of the key achievements from your career so far.
Oh, Dan, I think I've been fortunate in having a great international experience with the different companies that I've worked with in different countries. So that's been a great achievement. I've also worked in companies where there's been a turnaround needed. Or a growth from almost zero up to $250 million turnover over 4 years. So I've been particularly proud of that, building a finance function that's been scalable along the way. But I think one of the things that sticks out in my mind is being nominated and coming up runner-up in 2019 for the Yorkshire Finance Leaders Award, which was a great recognition amongst my peers for the work that I had done in the business, growing that international business by 120% top line.
Great stuff. Thank you. And if you reflect over your career to date, and as you've already highlighted, many successes along the way and a great journey so far, what sort of decisions did you make early on in your career that you think have benefited you further down the line?
Yeah, good question. I think earlier in my career, I didn't allow myself to be pigeonholed in a particular industry or a particular segment. I was able to make sure that I broadened my experience by joining different industries and not being daunted by it. I mean, when I worked for British Airways, for example, the idea of going into manufacturing, automotive manufacturing, you know, most people would be gasped by that. But I took on that challenge. And to be honest with you, for the first 3 months, I did wonder whether it was the right decision to make. But in hindsight, that decision set me in a great position for learning about lean cultures and Six Sigma and manufacturing organizations that in years to come would benefit me in getting other positions. So not stopping in a particular industry or a particular segment, I think has been a big a part of my success in my career.
Fantastic, thank you. Yeah, some highlights indeed, not just in the UK, but overseas as well. So that brings us up to the modern day, as it were. And you know, I'd be interested to hear how your leadership style has evolved through the COVID era. Have you learnt anything from the crisis as a finance leader specifically? And you know, do you have some positives to take away from the experience?
Sure. Well, I've learned the importance of having a good broadband internet at home. That's been very important over that period of time. But sure, I mean, the past 2 years has been a unique experience for all of us with the emergence of the global pandemic, which really emerged within a month and moved us from 100% office space to 100% working from home almost overnight. And almost also, you know, the instant recession of the global trade and supply chain disruptions that happened during Brexit also were incredibly challenging. Yet despite these almost once in a generation challenges, we ended up closing books on time, and the finance leadership really had to adapt quickly. And like myself, the style of leadership had to adapt very quickly as well. Luckily, I'd worked for organizations where we had remote working and had to manage teams remotely. So I had the skill sets already to be able to manage teams remotely when they eventually went working from home. But certainly companies in general were looking at the time to the finance team to help navigate through the uncertainty, and whether it was trying to understand these new rules for furlough regulations or managing cash flows at a critical time, or even preparing for the impact of Brexit, finance, you know, we found ourselves in the center of all of that. I think I felt as a leader that I needed to draw on all the experiences and training I'd had to approach each of these problems really methodically, and really work the numbers, work through what the implications were going to be, and try and bring some certainty to really a time when all of us were uncertain about the future. I didn't have all the answers, and I knew that, and I knew that those around me were looking for direction in trying to make some sense of what was going on. So I remained calm, began tackling each of the problems, getting teams together, and making sure that we worked on work solutions together. I think as a finance leader in a crisis, I learned that we are uniquely placed to bring various functions together to help navigate in a crisis. And if anything, the positive for me was that no matter how big the challenge, the team needs experience and experienced leaders to help through a crisis, and needs leaders to, you know, really just keep their heads, remain calm, and work through problems when everyone around them is looking at them for direction and leadership.
Very good, thank you. And if you then think about your current role, and clearly that's a role that oversees and leads not just people in different on different sites, but people in different countries as well. What are the challenges as you see them, and the keys to successfully managing multi-territory teams across different countries?
Yeah, Dan, as you say, I lead teams of finance professionals in multiple sites in the UK, in sites in Holland, France, and in Thailand, and we you know, look after sales offices in Turkey and in the Middle East. So it is a unique challenge, and managing remote teams is something that has to be learnt, and you need to you have a unique set of skills to be able to do that. I think the key for me is to build strong relationships with the finance leaders and have a level of empathy and understanding of their cultures, of their backgrounds, in order to get the best out of them. I've worked very hard with the current team to build those relationships and getting to know them both in terms of their work challenges, but also their personal backgrounds, what they've done, where they are in their life cycle, and their families. I have a monthly call with each of them just to talk through the challenges that they have with the teams and any other issues that they may have in terms of managing the workload. But also, you know, we have regular communications on the workload and topics as they come up. Ideally, meeting in person helps to build that relationship. But as you know, with COVID, we've not really been able to travel. So over the last few years, I've just had to make do with Teams calls, although hopefully in the post-COVID era, I'll be able to meet my teams face-to-face and continue building that relationship. I think ensuring finance leaders are clear about what the outcomes are, I think, is important. And what I've done is made sure that from the outset, it's clear about what the objectives are and what's expected of each of the finance teams. And leading them across multiple territories, we have a lot of commonality. So I brought those teams together from time to time to share their understandings and share what the challenges are and solutions that they've come up with. At the same time, I've tried to be available to those teams in case they have specific challenges, both locally and with the US office, and you know, want to make sure that they feel supported, irrespective of the fact that there's different time zones that I've had to deal with. But I guess I'm used to that now. With my prior roles living in Asia, I often worked with Europe and US teams. So managing my diary to accommodate early mornings and late nights is something I've certainly got used to, and my wife has definitely had to get used to.
And if you reflect over your longer career, what do you feel you've learned about leadership during your career? And can you identify a particular person who shaped your approach?
Oh, wow. That's a good question, Dan. I think over the years, my leadership has really developed from being a task-focused leader to being a lot more about the people and understanding that the people are really the people, the drivers and the solution, the people who bring the solutions to problems. I think the most valuable lesson that I've learned over the years as a leader is that you don't have to have all the answers. It's not incumbent just by being a leader that you have all the answers. In fact, it is better when you don't have the answers, because it focuses your attention on bringing people together and listening to possible solutions. I think that's been the most powerful tool for me as a leader, to be able to listen and draw on ideas from diverse opinions and formulate solutions from those that brings along the people rather than just being the person who comes up with an idea and says, that's the way we're gonna go, irrespective of how people feel about it. I've been very fortunate in having some amazing leaders that I've worked for and I've learned from. I guess one that comes to mind is a GM that was on at the site lead for the Philippines site when I was working there, called Carl Backlund. And Carl was an experienced GM. He came into the business really to establish the Greenfield site in the Philippines. And I admired the way that he would listen to people, whether it be from the shop floor or his own leadership team, and work through problems. He would always remember what people's names were and understood, you know, the importance of being able to address people personally. And you know, he taught me a valuable lesson in that, you know, you don't always have to make a decision there and then. There is a time when you have to make an immediate decision, and there are times when it's okay to say, no, you know what, I'm gonna think about that and come back to you. So it's important to be able to gauge those moments and make the decisions when they really do need to be made and not make it too quickly, if you like.
Good stuff. And if we look at the year ahead, what are your priorities as a finance leader through 2022?
Well, there are a lot of priorities. One is to start getting used to the hybrid working system that we've now adopted. And making sure that people are comfortable with the coming into the office, because having been away from the office for such a long time, it does take a bit of adjusting to come back to the office, and making sure that people continue to see the benefits of the technology that we've adopted. So continue to use things like Teams and other tools to communicate. I think the biggest challenge for me right now, if you ask me, is about recruiting and retaining talent. Over the last few months, it's become a significant issue for us. And for the past 2 years, finance professionals have pretty much stayed, as most other functions have, stayed put. And it's becoming apparent that as businesses start to rebound, they're starting to rebuild their support functions, and demand for good finance professionals is outstripping supply today. And we're having to focus on ways that we can recruit and retain our talent. So I think this year, talent development is going to be a key part of my agenda. It's really been on standstill for the last couple of years, where, you know, one-on-one coaching workshops has been missed, and we need to rapidly formulate training needs analysis to identify where people need to get used to the new ways of working, new technology, and new working practices, and equipping our talent for the new post-pandemic era. I think there's a lot that we've learned that we need to put into practice in our processes to help us, you know, go forward and streamline our processes, because we've learned that actually you don't necessarily need paper shifting from one place to another anymore. What was normal before can be done electronically, and can be done well, very well electronically. So I think retaining the talent and making sure that we build on those processes and those learnings is an important priority for next year, for this year anyway.
Thank you. There's already been a lot of regulatory upheaval recently, and look, there's more on the horizon as well, with UK SOCs, etc., as an example. How's this impacting your work and your priorities?
Sure. I mean, I'm used to working in SOCs framework organizations, from Ford Motor Company to other US multinationals. They've been SOCs compliant for many years, and working in that kind of framework, I'm very comfortable with, and I think there's a lot of value in embarking on that journey for any company. It's a journey that doesn't happen overnight. It takes a lot of time to implement robust controls and processes. And also, you know, it should be a part of the deliverables and priorities, because I think as much effort is put into putting these frameworks in, it actually helps in the long term with solving issues that finance tend to find that they have to fix at the end of each month. So if we solve the process issues, I think we can solve some of the issues that we have later on down the month, at the month end to fix. I think in terms of the workload priorities, I believe it's an integral part of our priorities to put in place robust frameworks that allow the processes to have checks and balances in place, but also allow the processes to be auditable.
Irfan, it's interesting that you mentioned you've spent considerable time in SOX environments. Clearly, there are lots of organisations out there in the UK that are going to be entering into UK SOX compliance for the first time, and this is a new territory for them. I mean, what insight or advice can you give to business leaders and companies who are exploring this and entering into this for the first time?
Sure. Dan, the first time I came across SOX was in South Africa, where I was the lead for implementing Sarbanes-Oxley framework for Ford Motor Company in South Africa. And I think the first key important part of any framework is to have senior leadership buy into to this. So we had a presentation to all the senior leadership team from all the functions to explain the benefits of Sarbanes-Oxley and what it entails. And effectively, it's a framework that demonstrates robust processes and controls that segregate responsibilities, so you don't have conflict of interest, but also documents those processes such that you can make sure that they are repeatable. And it's not just a finance function, it actually looks at processes across the whole organization. And once we'd established that, then getting SOX champions from each of the functions was important, and creating a timeline and framework for implementing certain stages was crucial. You're never going to be able to do this rapidly. You need to have a realistic timeline. It's a journey that takes multiple years to complete, but it starts with recognizing the current processes that the businesses have, and then looking at documenting those and improving those over time to become a SOX compliant framework. At the end of it, you would have an audit. Usually by, you know, if it's a large enough company, an internal audit team who would come around and validate those processes and ensure that they're being complied to.
And how much of a priority at the moment are things like D&I and ESG? And I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on how organisations and therefore business leaders should keep moving these forwards.
Sure. I mean, look, certainly environmental social governance has been around for a while, but it's becoming more and more of a hot topic at the moment. And there's more regulatory reporting on these goals being pushed onto companies. So the pressure is certainly on to recognize those. I see it as like with any other operational metric. It starts with choosing the appropriate metrics to measure and learning and working on processes to report those metrics, whether it be traditional CO2 measures or building in the full impact of our supply chain into our costing models. All of these things need to be established, and we need to understand what those are and what the baselines are before we can start making improvements. I think once you start to measure these, we can start formulating plans to improve them and improve the company's impact on the environment. I think even in investment decisions today, we're having to look at things that have a negative impact on ESG and measure those so that we make the right investment decisions for the long term for the business. I think it's important for all organizations to acknowledge their impact and recognize that future business could be adversely affected if they don't take steps today to understand the environmental impacts that they have on our environment.
And if we look at the world you're in right now in terms of the aerospace and engineering sector, what particular challenges are you facing within this sector in light of wider economic and social factors?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges that, you know, we're facing right now is that aerospace and engineering sectors normally have long-term agreements, and those long-term agreements set out pricing for many years. And today, with the challenges that we have on cost, and costs going increasing rapidly, it's becoming a big challenge to maintain those long-term agreements. And we're finding we're having to go back and renegotiate and discuss price changes as a result of them. So I think that's a big challenge. Obviously, the aerospace industry as a whole has been impacted by COVID and the travel restrictions. Although right now, single aisle traffic is picking up quicker than the double aisles and the wider body aircraft that are used on longer distances. And I think over the next few years, we're going to see the carbon footprint on air travel, along with people shortening their supply chains, will favour like smaller aircraft and smaller, more efficient aircraft over the larger aircraft that we've seen being quite prominent in the past. We also have, you know, the issues of recruitment of talent in the aerospace industry and in engineering, because again, you know, those functions are struggling to retain people who are moving to other kinds of industries that aren't as impacted and are growing pretty rapidly, certainly like the digital based industries and deliveries and stuff. So I think that's been a real challenge to maintain those engineering folks and maintain that talent within the business.
Absolutely. Thank you, Irfan. And if we talk about technology and the role of technology in finance, you know, in many ways, these two things are continuing to converge. How's that influenced your role and the work your team do?
Well, like I alluded to earlier on, I think the technology, it's heartening to see how quickly finance teams have embraced the new technology and recognized that actually there's a huge value in that technology. So the speed with which we were able to reshape budgets, conserve cash, you know, adjust to working from home and adapting to new tools has been, you know, hugely encouraging. And I think in terms of the new technology that's out there, I think finance is really well placed to to take advantage of all that new technology, such as Power BI and retooling the forecasting processes to make them more agile, having all this uncertainty that we've experienced. So I think finance teams are going to be embracing the new technology much more quickly than they have done in the past, and recognize that the role of the finance person doesn't necessarily have to be the manual payment processes so on and so forth, and can be automated to a certain extent, allowing them to do much more analytical work.
Absolutely. And finally, your advice to people moving into senior finance leadership positions who make sure they want to progress their career in the right way, what would you say to them?
Oh, wow. What advice would I give? I don't know. I'm not sure there's any one piece of advice that I can give them to prepare them for the enormous responsibility that comes with a leadership role in the finance function. I guess the one thing that I would say is that they should never be daunted by the challenges ahead, and they should see every problem as an opportunity to learn and apply their skills. And because it is the accumulation of all those skills and all those experience that eventually gets you through the most uncertain of times.
Fantastic. Irfan, thanks very much for joining us. Really interesting to hear your career story. And thanks for all your time. We look forward to seeing you all again on the next episode of our Executive Career Chat series. But for now, it's goodbye. And thanks very much.
To hear more from our guests, including their extraordinary careers and expert advice, make sure you subscribe to the Career Chats podcast, available on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, to get the episodes as soon as they drop.